advise them to use the guest parking garages, but they're all full, they can't park there. So this is where we're having a problem unexpectedly, is having a real problem. But we have a few people here, we can get started, and hopefully the others will show up soon. My name is Ruth Sesko, and I assist in scheduling the readabouts. And if any of you are interested in reading, presenting sometime, give me a call, look me up. Or if you know someone else who is interested, please welcome a variety of people from anywhere on campus or off. And next time we'll try to accommodate better with parking, if that be the case. Today we have the executive director from of the Hiawatha Library Association, Linda Hengst, who, while Hiawatha promotes and recognizes and tries to encourage the development of Ohio authors. So we have you here. Okay. Tell you a little bit about Hiawatha and our special guests who speak and read today for their own works.
Good afternoon. Sure, it's not the prettiest day I've ever seen out here, but campus is always lovely, and it hasn't changed much in the many years since I was here in terms of trying to find parking. So happy Valentine's week. This is a better week than last week as far as snowstorms. I have family that live in central Pennsylvania and eastern Pennsylvania, and they haven't seen light of day hardly since last Friday morning. So 40 plus inches of snow is a bit overwhelming. As Ruth said, I'm the executive director of the Ohioana Library. The Ohioana Library was founded in 1929. Our mission is to promote, to recognize, to foster Ohio writers, and to collect and preserve their work. We actually have four programs. One, our collection, which is the oldest. Collection contains 45,000 books, all written by Ohioans, or they're about Ohio or Ohioans. We add between 600 and 1,000 new books each year. So we're continually celebrating and being excited about the fact that new writers are emerging, recognized writers are continuing to write. So the collection also contains about 10,000 pieces of sheet music, all Ohio related, and biographical files of more than 25,000 Ohio writers, musicians, artists, and others of note. I'll just give a definition of an Ohioan for us. You were born here and at least spent, you know, a day, or you have lived in Ohio for at least 5 years. We make a few exceptions, and one of those exceptions is for O. Henry, who really was incarcerated in the Old Ohio Penitentiary for 4 years and 3 or 5 months. But he started writing his short stories while he was incarcerated there. So our second program, and oh, we want some goodies. I'll put those out for everybody in a minute. These are our Ohioana Annual Awards. They begin with a career award for someone who's had an outstanding career in the arts and humanities through a writing program for high school students. Those awards are given each fall. Then, starting in 1958, we produced the Ohioana Quarterly, in which you'll find reviews of recently published books. I brought several copies of these with me today. And I brought the fall issue because in there you'll find information about this last year's book award winners and other award winners, citations, the Marvin Grant, etc. And then our fourth program, and the newest, is a part of our community outreach, and that's the Ohioana Book Festival, which is held each spring in May. It will be May 8th for the festival. It will be held in the building we share with the State Library of Ohio, which has a lot of free parking. It's at 274 East First Avenue. You go down High Street to First, you go east on First, and when you've gotten too far, or when you run into the railroad track, you'll back up one building and you'll find us in that building. We'll have 10 featured authors around which the program will be based, plus another 70 to 80 authors who will be there during the day, who will be signing their books, talking with visitors, doing readings, perhaps participating in a panel discussion. We'll also be doing outreach the week before the festival. And Karen and the other authors who are here will be fair authors and have a chance to see their books, buy their books, and talk more with them. So with that, I will invite you all to the festival on May 8th. And then, let's jump into what today is all about. Romance. Romance covers so many, many types of books. And Karen Shaw will be reading first, and her book is a futuristic. Is that correct?
Yes, futuristic.
And look at my cheat sheet here. Karen lives in Westerville. She holds a degree in English as a writing art, also an MLS in Library and Information Sciences. And when she was a youngster, she used to write herself into TV programs that she watched. Before she went to bed, that was her imagination. So, she loves to read, she loves paranormals, she loves romances as long as they have good characters and a satisfying, happy ending. I had to laugh when I read in the Bible that she has been bitten by a number of animals, from a cockatiel to a prairie dog. She is an animal lover. And she lives with an amazing husband, and I love the way she says that. An amazing husband, brilliant children, and a few four little creatures.
Well, we're down to one now. Unfortunately, the husband will be able to.
But Karen will be reading from her first novel, which came out in December, and the title of that is Star Trek. And I'm going to turn it over to Karen.
Okay. Well, because this is kind of a college situation, I'll just give a really quick spiel about futuristics or science fiction romances. They're coming more now to be called because the science fiction is starting to be a greater world set. The reason I like science fiction romance, and I also write other things, but I really like science fiction romance because, like all science fiction, you can go into things that, you can delve into issues in our world that really affect you and say something without bringing people down. I mean, I went through English as a writing art and I read all the good, you know, the literary fiction and everything, and it was all fine, except nobody ever learned anything. Nobody ever changed. And that's why I write genre fiction, because in genre fiction, your character goes through a change. They make a change. They identify something in their lives that allows them to go on and accept love. And I think we all pretty much have to have, you know, different levels of that in our own lives, whether it's, you know, love in our family or love with somebody in a romantic sense. But we all have to, you know, come to a place, even if we're just, we had a perfectly normal childhood, we're perfectly normal, we still have to get to a place where it's more important for us to make the other person happy. If we want to have a truly, you know, a truly good relationship, we want to get to that place where we lose the selfishness of being a child and realize that, hey, I can give a few things up and still be myself and, you know, find a real relationship with someone. So that's the spiel on romance. And these are my, they're not really goodies because they're business cards, because I found out that I had my goodies, which are bookmarks, were all gone. But I hope people will take one and go to my website. I have a free short story on there. So, you know, nothing's better than free. So, you know, if you get snowed in or you know, you're trying to avoid doing serious work, you can, you know, go to my website and you'll find the short story for download right there. You know, it's just a very short story. So just something a little taster. Okay. And before I get into this, I'll just give you just a little background on this. It's kind of a heavy topic, slavery. But, you know, you always thought, well, if I was alive during slavery, I would have been in the Underground Railroad. We all, I think, would like to believe that. I tend to be the law-abiding kind of person. I'm a little afraid of the law, so I don't know if I would have been brave enough, but I would like to think that I would be. So my character Tia, although she works, she's a space pirate, although she's on a pirate ship, and they have slaves, she's secretly been working her whole life to at least ferry children out of harm's way. She isn't at the point where she can risk her whole life to that. That's part of the growing process. But she does risk her life for the children to help save children from being raised in slavery. So that is my heroine, and my hero is Rourke, and I'm going to start with him. So I hope you'll get to know him through these pages. I guess I'll sit down. Rourke Allryn sat bolt upright in his narrow bunk. Oh wait, I have one more warning. I apparently write words that I have a lot easier time writing than I have saying, so I may run into those. Try not to laugh. Well, you can't laugh, it's okay. Rourke Allryn sat bolt upright in his narrow bunk, the cool white linens pooling at his waist. An alarm assaulted his ears. The potent tones seemed to color the air in surging waves of violent red and purple. "Computer, report," he said into the pulsing air. There was no response, only the continued torturous repeat of the same throbbing resonance, shredding nerve endings and echoing in the marrow of his bones. His mind superimposed the Spartan but elegant lines of his quarters on the Courageous, his own ship, on top of the cramped confines of the utilitarian cabin allotted mechanics on the Koya. He squinted against the brightness of the white ceiling light triggered by the alarm, and the illusion dissolved. Memory flooded back. He bolted from the bed and shrugged into his dun coveralls. Zipping them up, he reached for his duffel bag and snatched the small handheld holodisplay he'd requisitioned. He held it in front of his face. "Grail," he said to commence transmitting. "Rourke." Grail's familiar features rose from the matrix. Rourke's face had been slightly altered, as it always was when he worked undercover. But Grail Singer, president of the Union of Planets, Rourke's boss and best friend, apparently had no trouble recognizing him. It was the middle of the night on Rija, but Grail's unrumpled condition revealed he hadn't been to bed. "Report." Rourke pitched his voice above the strident shriek of the alarm. "It started. The pirates are using fire as a diversion, just as John said they would." Grail's eyes narrowed, his mouth thinned. "Finally," he sighed, lines of worry etched into his forehead. "Be careful. I don't want to lose you, too." Rourke nodded. He would never forget the sight of John Borland's corpse. The cold, dry vacuum of space had preserved his old friend perfectly, but the lines of his face had been barely recognizable. His once hazel eyes had been scorched in their sockets, his craggy face scorched with a laser blade. He'd been tortured before he'd been spaced. Rourke had to swallow the rage clogging his throat before he could answer. "Don't worry, I'm gonna get these bastards." The expression in Grail's blue Rigen eyes was grave. "Remember, John gave us the evidence we need to bring down Captain Sen and the crew of the Tiger. All you have to do is plant the tracking device and we'll come and intercept you. No heroics." Rourke nodded, impatient to be off. Grail ran a large hand through his short black hair. "Remind me again why I'm letting my new head of defense do this." "Because John was like a father to me, and I've already lost far too much to scum like this." He didn't say the last words out loud, but they hung in the air as if he had. Grail shook his head. "Rourke, Kushbu wouldn't want what, revenge?" Grief pressed down on him like gravity after zero-G. "This isn't about that. The pirates that killed her are dead. But it doesn't help, does it? Grail." His friend ran another hasty hand through his hair. 2 days, that's all I'm giving you. 2 days. If we don't get the signal by then, I'm coming after you." Grail out. The hologram vanished, leaving Rourke looking at empty air. A sigh escaped his lungs. Who knew what his wife would have wanted? She was dead, and his mission was all he had left. He took the tiny holodisplay and placed it on the floor. Seconds later, it was a pile of worthless bits. If only he could dismantle thoughts of Kushbu so easily. After he disposed of the fragments, Rourke took out the tracking device from the plant on his target and inserted it in its hiding place, a small pouch of fake skin on the back of his thigh. It was time to get to work. He closed his eyes and reached inside to bury the emotions threatening to swamp him. John's death had reawakened the old rage, and his anger was once again too raw, too new, and far too close to the surface. Calm at last, he gingerly touched the polished surface of the door with a palm. Though both his instincts and his information told him the alarm was merely a ploy, he couldn't ignore the very real danger of a fire on a ship. Finding the door cool, he took a deep breath, ripped it open, and edged into the darkened corridor. A faint, smoky haze hugged the ceiling, but otherwise the air seemed clear. Men, women, and children of almost every race in the galaxy crowded the narrow passage. Flashing red lights skewed the scene into a nightmare. Faces caricatures of fear, distances distorted. The babble of languages became an eerie song as Rourke, staying low, swam through the throng, using his hands to propel his large body through the densely packed corridor. The mass of humanity heated the hall. Rourke wiped the sweat from his eyes with a forearm. The bitter smell of smoke barely dented the stench of so many living things in distress so close together. The Mollins had very acute senses, and the offensive odor was almost painful to Rourke. He fought the urge to hold his breath. His body required oxygen, no matter what his rolling stomach said. He didn't need to follow the signs to find the landing bay and escape pod station. He'd memorized his location nearly a week earlier, the first day he'd joined the ship as a third-class mechanic. As he neared the station, the cloud acted like a tide, sweeping him along with them. The sight of the escape pods lined up like a string of chunky gray metal beads, hatches open, was welcome. The crew of the liner held scanners and checked off the names of passengers as they boarded the pods. Rourke's heart slowed. The landing bay was cooler, and the odor that had tormented him dulled to a tolerable level. He swept the bay with his gaze. At first glance, everything appeared to be under control. All John had been able to tell them before he'd been killed was the pirates were planning to use a fire to take the space liner Koya. Rourke had no idea when and how they would make their move. Not wanting to draw attention to himself, he entered the closest line. When he got to the officer in charge, a rather rat-faced human with tiny dark eyes, and gave him his name, the man shook his head. "This escape pod is only for families with children." Rourke's eyebrows flew up. A warning light went off in his head. He hadn't heard anything during the drills about separate ships for people with families. He smiled at the officer, covering his suspicion. "Which pod should I go to?" The man pointed to a line several yards away. "Thanks." Before he moved to the other line, Rourke discreetly sniffed the air. The telltale smell of blaster residue met his nose. As he moved on, he examined the rest of the crew members. A closer eye now revealed pants that were too short or puddled over his shoes, tunics that hung from skinny shoulders or stretched across barrel-like chests. The pirates had taken over, and no one had suspected a thing. Fury rose sharp and wild in his chest, urging him to action. His hands fisted. Primordial rage sang in his veins, warring with reason. He forced his anger away. "Stay calm. Focus, Elrin." So far, everything proceeded as planned. If Union forces were going to catch Captain Sen and his crew, he needed to locate the bastards. The tracking device he carried would lead Union troops directly to their quarry. As Rourke approached the young, tree-sized Targon at the end of his line, a bolt of blue fire shot into the bay and struck the man. He toppled. Rourke hit the deck, his hands stung from slapping the grating. He braced them on the cold metal, ready to move at a moment's notice, and rested his cheek on his hand as he watched the action. An older man, Rourke recognized as the Koya's first mate, stuck his head into the bay and fired off another shot, striking a lanky pirate several yards away. The captain, a tiny red-haired human woman with hair as curly as Telian wool, charged to the bay, followed by several of the Koya's crew, all wearing only the skin-tight, sleeveless black undersuits customary for a ship's crew, civilian or military. The pirates were still standing, ducked around the sleek bulkheads of the ships for cover. They began returning fire at the crew. The captain and her people advanced, dodging and weaving to avoid the blaster fire zinging toward them. Shouts and footsteps bounced off the walls of the bay as the crew yelled instructions to each other and took cover behind the glass steel columns hiding the emergency doors, which would open if the bulkhead were breached. Another pirate fell, and then the captain of the liner was hit. She collapsed to the floor without a sound, her freckled face pale and still. The sight of her staring brown eyes brought to mind another, dearer pair of eyes. For a moment, it was Kushbu, his wife, falling again as she had that day on Space Station 7, never to rise again. The rage he tamped down until it was nothing more than smoldering coals flared into an inferno in his chest. Mere hand spans away, the captains blessed or tantalized. Hell with the law. He would kill the bastards, every one. Before he could flush his mission down the waste disposal unit, two pirates, a wiry human man and a towering Targon woman with her people's typical brown-spotted skin, stormed into the landing bay, blasters blazing. They exchanged fire with the tall, slim female crew member pinned down behind the center column. She leaned out to shoot, stiffened, and pitched to the floor, the victim of a well-timed blaster bolt. And the defense of the Koya ended. For a moment, he imagined attacking the pirates, going down in a lightning storm of blaster fire. But he wasn't alone in this. He had to live to fight another day. "What are you looking at, Amalin?" The wiry pirate smirked, eyes alight with cold triumph. It was all Rourke could do to stop himself from jumping the man. The pirate who appeared to be in charge looked him up and down, noting the coveralls Rourke wore. "What are you, a mechanic?" "Yeah." Rourke stood slowly, standing with his feet spread apart, hands fisted at his sides. The man smiled, though it was more of a grimace. His eyes were intense, black as space and as dead as Rourke's hope. "I don't like the way this mechanic is looking at me, Caver." The man's voice was low and soft with a vicious edge. He spat the word mechanic as if it made him sick to even say it. "I think he's going to be trouble." The Targon woman's mouth tightened. "Jeb?" He raised a hand, cutting her off, and smiled again. The woman's brown eyebrows pulled together, but she didn't speak. Jeb gestured to two pirates, an older Targon man and an Orion with the Siamese cat elongation of his kind. The men circled around behind Rourke and seized him by the arms, their fingers digging into his flesh with bruising force. The wiry pirate reached into his pocket and took out a pair of ancient brass knuckles, dark with tarnish perhaps, or something more sinister than oxidation. He slipped them on, grinning, his small eyes gleaming with malevolent intent. Rourke prayed he hadn't traded death by blaster for being beaten to death. He'd much rather be shot. Is that enough for now?
Yes, and others should be coming in soon, but would you entertain some questions?
Sure. Happy to answer any questions people have about, I don't know, almost anything.
I'm going to ask
you. Okay.
What is your writing process? Where do you write?
I write on my sofa. I have a little netbook, so I pretty much just sit on my sofa and write, and my kids annoy me, and then I, you know, try to get back to what I was thinking of. And actually, I kind of move around with my laptop, and it gets into some precarious positions. Today, actually, my dog managed to take one of the keys off. So, my husband keeps telling me something's going to happen to that, you know, and things do, but you know, anything you use every day is gonna get some wear and tear. That's what I'm telling myself anyway. So.
Do you work on one thing at a time, or do you work on two or three different?
I used to work on one thing at a time, but I've changed how I work since I started. I started writing formally about 10 years ago and just got published, which kind of tells you about the publishing world. In fact, I'm still published. I'm published with a small press called Samhain Press. And that's not a big New York, you know, brick and mortar type place. So my books are available on Amazon, and they're available through the publishing company's website. And they're in some brick and mortar stores, but because it's a small press, they don't order a ton of them. So where was I? Oh, yes. I used to write each scene until I thought it was absolutely perfect, you know? And I was absolutely satisfied, and then I would move on to the next. But that takes like a year, and I have all these other ideas brimming in my head, and really in order to, if you really wanna get yourself out there and get your name known, you gotta be submitting a lot. You have to have a lot to submit. And if you craft everything very carefully and wait until that's done to query and to start the process. I have had something in New York at a New York publishing company. I've had one manuscript there for 5 years. They never responded to me. I know they have it because I got the little postcard back. I know they had it, but if I call them or email them, I don't get a response. They just, you know, that it's just the way it is over there. But in any case, you have to kind of keep things moving. So I stopped doing that. Also, the other thing is that you get these great scenes, and then you read the whole book, and you like, you all of a sudden realize, I loved this scene. It serves no purpose. It doesn't advance the plot. It doesn't advance the empathy for the characters. It doesn't do anything. So then you've worked for a month on, you know, a scene, and it goes in the garbage. You know, so it, you just really can't, if you work like that, I mean, obviously some people have to work like that, but I made myself change my way of doing it, because I just hated to see so much of my work just getting thrown out. And if I just write a sketchy scene and later on I realize it's not doing something, I can either throw it out, I don't have much emotional connection to it at that point, or I can, you know, add things to it that make it actually mean something to this, to the way the story is going. So basically I have all these little planes on my runway at all times, and all vying to be worked on. I have a children's manuscript that I'm working on now, but I also have a couple other things in the middle of revisions.
I understand that's the way it is for a lot of people. Beethoven has entire volumes of a single major of music for violins that evolved over the years for one major, for 4 or 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then people like Handel, who wrote his music, and he felt his divine inspired, and it just popped into his head, and he scribbled down stuff on tables and walls so that he couldn't forget it, because he wanted to be able to use it when he was writing, but he wasn't prepared at that.
Writing is like that. And I'll wake up at 2:00 in the morning, and I'll have to get up and write something down, otherwise it's going to chase me around my head all night. So, you know, writing kind of gets addicting. Once you're doing it, you know, it's hard, but you don't want to stop. You just want to keep doing it. It's a torturous good feeling. I can't. It's hard to explain it, but it really is.
It seems to be very individualistic kind of thing, too.
Yeah. It's
interesting to hear about.
It's hard because people want to come to you and say, take this idea, and you're like, I already have 20 million of my own ideas that I don't have time to write. So, you know, it's you never really want to adopt somebody else. Well, thank you.
Okay, Susan and Jules have made it here, and we're going to now go back and pick up on Susan Gee. Hero, is that how I pronounce it?
G. Hano.
Hano. Okay. Susan has made a career of changing jobs. Her little resume said she has worn steel-toed shoes, done legal research, held a real estate license, worked as a caterer, a theater director, a youth director, and I saw a few more listed there, but that kind of covered a gamut, I thought. But only writing has really held her attention year after year. When her children arrived, she changed her focus from theater to romance. And in 2008, she was awarded the Romance Writers of America's Golden Heart Award for the best Regency history romance. Her debut novel, Mistress by Mistake, was released just in December 2009. This novel, which was under a different title, was the Golden Heart Award winner. And so it is my pleasure to present to you Susan Gee Hero. And I said, and give her a little minute. Both Susan and Jules came in from very close to Cincinnati, so not only did they have a long drive, but they had the challenge of parking on Ohio State's campus. So, Susan,
thank you, Linda. I apologize for us being late. Actually, Jules lives by Cincinnati, and I live by Marion.
Oh, okay.
And so we met up halfway down and figured we'd, you know, find our way here. Y'all have a very big campus. And it's very pretty, and it's got a lot of hills, and it's very cold. So, you can have it. But I know, here comes Jules. Anyway, this is my book, Mistress by Mistake. Just came out in December, so it's new. So this is my first time I get to read it out loud to someone other than my friend Julie, who helped me to figure out how to do that. Now, Linda, I'll tell you what, how much time are we allotting since we're...
10 minutes, and then a few questions and answers, and then children.
Does that sound good? Okay. Alrighty, well, let's see. This is a historical romance. It takes place in the Regency time period in England, which is the time period in the early part of the 1800s when the king was unable to rule, and so his son, the prince, became regent and ruled for him during the 10-year time period before he actually took over as king. And it's usually the time period that you associate with Jane Austen. It's when her first novels were being published. So that's the time frame that we're dealing with. And in the romance world, the Regency setting is very popular. Do we have a lot of romance readers out here? Nobody wants to vote. Anybody actually read romances? Look at them all. Oh my goodness, I'm so glad. Anyway. A romance novel is just a novel that is different from literary fiction because it usually has a happy ending, and the main focus of the novel is the relationship of the hero and the heroine. You have two main protagonists, and the focus of the storyline is things surrounding the two main characters and what brings them together and builds that relationship. That's what makes it a romance novel. And so in this time period, I generally enjoy this period because of a lot of the social constrictions that go along with it, and the costumes are pretty. So this, in my story, I didn't hear what you read. Did you read the beginning, or did you just pick a spot?
I read most of the beginning.
Okay. Well, this will be the middle part of her beginning. I decided to read some of the middle parts rather than just jumping in the beginning. So I'm going to set it up really quick for you. My heroine is named Eveline Finchley, and she's an heiress, and she will have lots of money someday. And the hero is a Viscount, and his name is Lord Dashford, and he has a lot of money, but nobody thinks he has money, and everybody thinks he needs to snag a wealthy wife. And so you start out with that play on each other, that it's assumed that he's trying to find a wealthy wife, and she does not want to be somebody's wealthy wife. She wants to take her money and do her own thing. But what happened is in the beginning of the book, she got drunk, met this gentleman who she didn't know who he was, and so you had your lovely, classic, cliched, mistaken identity scene where it's a seduction in the moonlight, but she falls asleep, and so he carries her up and tucks her in his bed, and she wakes up there the next morning, assuming that much more had gone on than actually did. And then when she finds out who he is, that she's actually a guest in his house right now, she's been trying to avoid him, and he did not realize that was her. And so when they actually come face to face with one another now, realizing who each other are, there's some tension because they both assume that the other has designs on them, and they don't like that. So this is a scene in chapter 3, I believe. And they are just about to meet for the first time since they've figured out who each other is after they've had this romantic interlude while she was drunk. And it's at dinner time. They're just sitting down for a family dinner, and he's been avoiding the family and she's been avoiding him, but they can no longer avoid getting together. And he just walks in and gets a look at her, and she drops her lemonade all over herself. So she's busily trying to soak up lemonade as he comes in. He was looking at her. Eveline felt frozen, pinned under his sudden gaze as if they were the only two people in the room. the lemonade soaked unchecked into her gown, but she could do nothing. His eyes held her as firmly as if he had placed his hands on her. Everything she'd ever felt in his arms washed over her at once, and for a moment the room swam around her. Was she going to further mortify herself by swooning right here in front of everyone? "Randolph," his mother was saying, "this is the lovely Miss Eveline Pinchley, who you've so noticeably not yet had the pleasure of meeting." "Eveline," he said, but this time the sound was cold and dead. And what was coming over his eyes? An icy hardness she'd not seen before took over, and she was gazing at the startling face of a stranger. "What an uncommon name," he said. The chill in his voice was terrifying. "My father chose it," she said like an idiot. "I wonder what he'd think of it now," he said, and finally turned away from her to give his mother a dazzling smile. "Well, you see, I can be an obedient son after all, mother. Now, what would you prefer? Shall I simply lead you to your seat and call for the servants to bring in the first course, or shall I drop to one knee and offer for your Miss Pinchley right away?" Now it was Aunt Bella's turn to drop something. Her jaw hung slack, and an audible gasp escaped her. Eveline was surprisingly silent. Her worst fears were realized. Lord Dashford had never been carried away by pure animal lust for her. The heated passion she thought she'd felt between them had been purely one-sided. Drat this carnal weakness. Her base nature had led her into being deceived once again. Dashford never really wanted her. All along, he'd held but one goal. Cold-hearted seduction to trap her into marriage. He was like all the others. The only value she held for him was Papa's money. There was nothing but contempt in his eyes for her now. She'd seen enough of it in Aunt Bella's eyes to recognize it. What made her stomach churn and her throat constrict was the sudden realization that she cared what he thought of her. She cared deeply. Oh God, this was worse than she could have imagined. What Grandmama had said about the Dashford men was true. Eveline's inborn weakness still made her crave him, even though knowing what he obviously thought of her. However was she going to survive a polite dinner with the man? "It's rude to tease our guests so, Randolph," Lady Dashford said with a nervous laugh. "Oh, I had no idea my compliance with your schemes would be construed as rudeness," Dashford said, bowing as his mother gracefully sat into her chair. Then he turned and bowed toward Eveline. "I'm sure the fair and virtuous Miss Eveline will forgive me." Lady Dashford looked horrified, but there was clearly nothing she could do. Dashford continued, turning his attentions to Aunt Bella. "So you must be Miss Pinchley's aunt I've heard so much about." Aunt Bella actually appeared to blush under his piercing eyes and dizzying smile. Eveline had no idea the woman could be capable of such a thing. Clearly the Dashford dark magic worked on all females. "We met your mother during her stay in Bath this summer past," Aunt Bella said, her voice taking on a girlish giddiness as she batted her eyes in his direction. "She's such a dear to extend her hospitality to us." "Yes, isn't she just?" he agreed flatly, seating himself at the head of the table. "Now that I've kept you all waiting to bless you with my wonderful presence, why don't we eat?" The servants recognized their cue and rushed to set food before everyone. The guests fell into strained conversation, and Eveline forced herself to relax. Perhaps the worst was over. She could take a few deep breaths and get through this. No one seemed to suspect a thing yet. His lordship discoursed on favorite local spots for fishing, and she was pleased to find the other guests were happy to ignore her. She concentrated on keeping her face passive and pushing the food around on her plate. She wasn't going quite as unnoticed as she hoped, though. When she glanced up after several moments, it was to find Dashford's cold gaze on her once more. Oh, Lord, her face went warm and her blood pounded. "My dear Miss Pinchley," Lady Dashford said, startling her, "you've hardly eaten a thing. I'm becoming convinced our fare here disagrees with you." "Oh, certainly not," Eveline assured her, staring down at her plate and fighting back the urge to vomit on it. "Everything is lovely here." "Well," Lady Dashford sighed, "almost everything. I fear my son is showing us something less than his best side." No one quite seemed to know how to respond to that, but Lord Dashford just laughed. "Oh, don't worry, Mother," he said. "I'm sure Miss Eveline has been pleased enough with the sides of me she's seen so far. Pity I haven't had the opportunity to show her more." "Perhaps if you were to attend your guests more often than Miss Pinchley," Lady Dashford put special emphasis on the Miss Pinchley part to point out her son's too familiar use of their guest's first name, might at last have the opportunity. Lord Dashford's smile was not kind. He let it burn with an overabundance of familiar heat and directed it fully at Eveline. She knew precisely what he meant by it, too, and damn her, but she wanted to respond. Heavens, her cheeks felt on fire. What must everyone be thinking of them? Miss Pinchley is welcome to my attendance whenever she desires it, Dashford said in a slow, heated tone. I always strive to see that my guests' every need is met in full. Tell me, my dear Eveline, have you found your time here to be pleasurable thus far? He was toying with her. My, but the man was cold. He thought her a worthless strumpet to be used and then demeaned right here in front of everyone. Well, she had no one to blame but herself for that, she supposed. She was, however, not about to sit here and allow it. No, sir, she said firmly, I have found my stay here to be nothing less than tedious, in fact. Aunt Bella gasped and began to rapidly fan herself. Eveline forced herself not to notice. Tedious, ma'am, Dashford replied, far from offended. If she had to guess, she would have said his face showed nothing more than mild amusement at her outburst. Damn him. Oh, Lady Dashford has been kindness indeed, but I fear her son has a few too many shortcomings for my taste, she said, and hoped he got her meaning. Two could play at this stupid little game of insinuation and insult. His eyebrows rose slightly as the only sign he caught her intended slight. She took that as encouragement and went on. There is nothing further I desire at Hartwood than for this infernal rain to end so I may leave. The room was deadly silent, and Lord Dashford's eyes narrowed, though they never left hers. She wondered if perhaps she might have gone too far. He looked stormier than the clouds outside. What had she done? She'd been foolish enough to insult him in front of his guests and announce her wish to leave. What was stopping him from throwing her bags out in the elements and letting her make good on that desire? Drat. But if she was going to continue speaking her mind, she was going to have to learn to do it at more convenient times. Thank you very much.
I think we'll move on in the Jules Green and then answer questions for both. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Jules Bennett is our next reader, and Jules told her first romance in 2005.
Yes.
And she hasn't stopped since then. She sold 8 books to 3 different publishing houses. Her upcoming books will be with Silhouette Desire, and they will be published back-to-back in March and April. And you have one coming in June, don't you? Or July?
June and October.
Okay. I didn't see the other two, so she has a lot coming for her. She has received 4.5 and 5-star reviews on each of her books. Several have been recommended readers on online review sites. She won the Linda Howard Award for Excellence in 2005. But besides being a writer, Jules works part-time, handling a bustling salon, raising 2 little girls, and she's married to a high school sweetheart. And what better way to say, this is Valentine's Day. Move forward.
Thank you. Please do. As she said, my newest books are with Silhouette Desire, and this is the one that is coming out in March. It's called Seducing the Enemy's Daughter. And just a little backstory on it. The heroine in this has been given this resort by her father that he recently acquired through dirty business dealings that she knows nothing about. She just knows she has to get this resort up and running, out of the red, and bring it back to what it used to be. The family who previously owned it and it was stolen from planned to take it back. So the hero in this is from that company. He comes to the resort with every intention of spying, doing whatever he can to get this back. He has no idea the new owner is a woman. He just knows the person's name is Sam. So where I'm gonna start at is just about in the middle. And this is mostly a conversation between the heroine, Sam, and her brother, who is also into dirty business dealings, but she's still, she's very innocent in all this. She knows nothing about how her father and her brother deal with things. Sam studied her proposal, warmed at the thought someone took her seriously. But she wasn't giving up on her father. If she gave up on her dream for this resort, she'd regret it. Just like she regretted ever talking to Brady Stone. He'd planted an idea in her head, and she wished she could erase the tempting thought from her memory. Could she trust a virtual stranger to help her rejuvenate this resort? Heaven knows he'd done wonders in reviving her once-buried sexual urges. But this was business, and she had to keep her personal emotions locked away. Running this resort was her one and probably only chance to prove to her father. If, and that was a big if, she let Brady in and confided in him, what would stop him from using her weakness to open a greater resort right next door? Kauai was a growing island, and the last thing she needed was another competitor. Sam laughed. Obviously, her father's cynicism had rubbed off on her. Her gut told her to trust Brady. Besides, at this point, she needed someone in her corner. Sam took a seat at her desk, picked up her phone, and dialed her brother's office line. His secretary put the call through immediately. Sam, Miles' low, silky voice came through the phone. What's up? Has Dad talked to you about the resort, she asked. I know he's upset. Miles paused, but just enough to arouse Sam's curiosity. About? Ask Dad. Sam eased back in her seat, tucking the phone between her shoulder and her ear. I'm asking you. He sighed. It's not my place to say. Frustration flooded through her. The more you and Dad keep me out of the loop, the more damage you're doing to the company. Communication is the key to running a good business. Miles laughed. Sounds like you need to take your argument to the top, little sister. I'm an equal here, she told him. I need to know what's going on and you're not telling me. All right, Dad is concerned that if the numbers don't go up, he'll have to bring someone else in as manager, or as a last resort, he'll have to sell. He's giving you 6 more months. Shocked and disbelief settled into her chest. What? Now you see why Dad was so insistent on you turning the place around, Miles explained. How could the two of you keep something this vital from me? She demanded, gripping the phone. It wasn't my idea. Without saying goodbye, Sam hung up on her brother, more upset now than she'd been before. With her blood pressure rising, she punched in the number to her father's office. He answered on the second ring. Samantha, I'm very busy. Can this wait? Obviously, he'd looked at his caller ID, so why did he bother to even answer? No, it can't. For once he would listen to her and she would come before his precious companies. Make it fast. Sam crossed her legs, rocked back in her leather chair. Why the hell wasn't I informed that I've been working on a probationary period? I didn't feel it necessary to inform you. Sam gripped her padded armrest. Miles knows. Her father sighed. Sam, let it drop. You just take care of my resort. Blood pulsed through her head, her teeth clenched. Fine, she told him. I'll take care of everything on my end. Once she hung up the phone, Sam forced herself to breathe in slowly and exhale the same way. She needed to calm down and think before making any rash decisions. She'd tried. Nearly all of her life, she'd tried to gain her father's respect. As an adult, she'd practically begged him to earn a place in his company. Now she saw what he was really doing. As if she were a child, he seemed to just pat her on the head and humor her, giving her small jobs to keep her out of his hair. And even that was temporary. Well, no more. She was more than ready to be appreciated, more than ready to be taken seriously as a businesswoman. She wasn't sure what step to take next, but she knew one thing. She was done being pushed around by her father and her brother. Controlling men were officially a thing of her past. From here on out, if they didn't see her for the talented career woman she'd become, she would do what she wanted and what was best for her. Risky decisions may come back to haunt her, but she had to do something drastic, or at least consider her options. And if her father and Miles didn't appreciate her, she knew of someone who would make them. That is coming out in March, like I said, and the character Brady that was briefly mentioned, he's the hero in this, and his brother is the hero in my April release. So. Thank you.
Questions? Is your book a series then? Because
yeah. Not this one. That is confusing.
It does.
The The March and April book, that's a series. The, you know, those two are together. Then I have another series that will start in October, and that will run, you know, at the end of the next year, end of this year and into next year. So, you know, once I finish up a little series, then I start on a new one. So they're not all connected. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yes.
I think it'd be cool if, because you write single title and you write mostly category, if you would tell, well, most people probably don't know the difference between category and bulk title, so it might be cool to just say something about that.
I'll explain my end.
You explain your idea.
Okay. Category is, they're literally in a category. Harlequin has categories that their books are in to kind of fit what genre you like to read best. You know, there's everything from inspirational romance to hot steamy romance, and this is in between. This is more like Dynasty, the show Dynasty, corporate CEO type world. That's what category my books are in with Harlequin. So that's what category is. They're smaller reads, they're easy reads. You can read them in a day if you have the time. You know, it's just, they're cheap. They're, you know, convenient to throw in your purse. We like cheap in this economy. So that's where I like writing for category.
You have to have a specific voice too.
You have to have a specific voice, because I was targeting single title, which she'll explain in a minute. And I hadn't received an agent yet, and I was trying to get this one because I just loved her and I knew some of her clients. And she said, you need to pick up A Silhouette Desire, which is this, and read it, because I think that's what your voice sounds like. And I did, and I read a book, and I sent it in, and I sold it. And had I known that a long time ago, it wouldn't have taken me that long. But it just helps to get the right person to say, this is what your voice sounds like, this is where you need to be. So, yeah, I would never have found this had she not said that. So
I'm glad that she
did. I am too.
what I write would be considered single title, which is a book that is not a part of a category. Like she was explaining with Harlequin, they've got their various different lines, and it makes it easier for readers to know, you know, I like secret babies. Well, they're usually in you know, Harlequin Presents, they, you know, and so it kind of helps to let you, you know, figure that out. Well, whereas with the single title books, they don't have that, and you kind of have to look at the book itself and read the back and figure, okay, and do I like this author, and does this sound like what I want, because it's not, it's just a standalone single title. It's not a part of a category. Although a lot of single title books can be part of a series where you get a lot of authors.
A lot of more. That's a big trend.
Right. And so that's where it gets very confusing, where what, because this is called series romance, although not all of these are a series, because not all of Jules' books might be connected, even though they are a part of
a series.
And so that's where the confusion is. Whereas I write single title, and yet the book that I have that will be coming out this summer is a part of basically the series, because it takes characters from this book and follows another storyline. So even though mine are considered single title, they are connected with
and they're longer.
And they're longer.
They're longer. Right.
What's your word count on
this? Desire is one of the lowest ones for Harlequin, and mine is 55,000 words.
And how quick can you crash that out?
About 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay, mine is 120,000 words, and I have to bleed for about a year.
Same. So. Yeah. And my mind works fast. Like, I mean, I'll be halfway done with typing this book, for example, and I'm sick of it, and I'm ready to move on to the next one. So I'm already.
So you have to.
Before I finish this half, I'm already taking notes for the next one. Because my mind is just. And I have toddlers. So my mind just constantly goes. And really fast.
See, I'm still not quite done with that one that I just read. I really want to go back and fix some things.
Yes,
I know.
I should have said that to
you. I know.
Yeah, I already said it. Yeah.
I don't read after when the book comes out, I'm not reading it.
Oh, no.
Not reading it. I'll just be like, oh, no. Now I should have taken this and paste it. You know, I'm not going to read it again.
Are there other questions? Well, one of
questions we always ask is the writing process. You've already filled us in, but on that, you're just jumping ahead to the next book.
Because her mind moves so fast.
Yeah. My October book, I just signed for it, and I'm writing the two for next year right now. So yeah, it's jumping ahead.
It is. It's one of those kind of industries where you work really, really hard, and you sit and wait.
And then you wait.
Anyway. And then out of the blue, you get an email, and they say, oh, we need you to do all these changes or whatever.
By tomorrow.
And so you say, sorry, children, you don't get to have a birthday party this weekend. Mommy's got to work. And so then you work really, really, really hard, and you wait.
It is either or it's nothing.
Yeah. So you do kind of need to have other projects going at the same time, and that gets to be really hard, because before I was published, I could just focus on one thing at a time and write this book as long as I wanted to. Every single day I was just writing this book over and over and over again. Not this one, by the way. It was many books ago. But then once you've got deadlines and people on top of you, you've got to learn to juggle back and forth between two or three projects at a time.
So would they pretty much require that you produce a
They like it.
Category.
This is out in March, then it'll be gone. I mean, you can still get it online. It'll be in the stores through March, gone. My next one that comes out in April will be in April, and then it's gone. And then the May books move in. You know, it's just a constant cycle.
So they like to keep their authors very, very
busy. Yeah, they do keep you busy. But they like for you to have a certain amount a year just to keep your reader base, because you know, if you only have one every year or one every other year, your readers are going to forget about you. You know, especially, I don't know about with other genres, but I know with romance, women read them like that. They're really, you know, fast.
Not faster than we can write them.
Exactly. So if I have say I just had this book out this year, then if I had a book out next year, I'm almost another new author and I have to start all over with promotion. So yeah, that's why that keeps their sales good. And that's why they, you know, want you to, you know, this is your career. So, yeah, you have to really buckle down and get it done.
Years ago, I worked at the high school public library, and we would check out some little ladies with a little shopping bag, and they would load up all the romance novels to check out. And they check out like 50 at a time. And then one, I remember one time we ran out, I literally beat them up, and our supervisor sent us with the petty cash money.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I don't think that happens anymore.
No.
I
don't
think so. What would happen if we went to our public libraries and stole all the romance novels? I know. Wait a minute, I have to
leave my car.
Really?
Oh, and did you put stuff back there?
What?
Did you put any credits in there?
I have.
Karen has cards here.
Ooh, good thinking.
And then Susan and I have stuff on that table back there.
I'll put some bookmarks.
I have bookmarks and pens too. So, I mean, take whatever you want.
The core piece that I promised here as well. So. And one last thing.
Yes,
romance is the number one selling.
Yes,
that's
it is.
That's right.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. People like to look down at those as genre fiction, but they either need me or my
Well, we did look up this issue of the quarterly that I brought, the issue before. Part of the reason I have been introduced just really recently in the last few years to romance from some of the authors who I've gotten to meet at Ohana. And it was like, you know what? They're totally different than the image.
It's different than what you think it's going to be.
Absolutely.
And plus, there's so many little subgenres.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I love suspense. Love it. So I tend to read romantic suspense, but I want more suspense than romance. I just write romance. You know what I mean? So there's so much. There's like science fiction. There's contemporary, which is what I write. There's historical. I mean, there's just a lot of different venues.
Paranormal. I just finished reading. I will not mention the author's name. He is a very prominent Ohio mystery novelist. Major best-selling author, and I just finished his last two novels and said they were great romances. Mm-hmm. And you go back and write a prejudice. was a,
yeah,
a romance. But yes, last year, the one area of growth in the publishing market and the buying was in romances. And it was like, we've got to look at this. This is an important aspect of literature in our time.
Well, I think the quality is improving.
Absolutely.
As the competition has increased.
Oh, it's awful. Not awful, but I mean,
it's
hard.
It's really, really hard. I mean, you got the impression, back when I first started reading romance when I was a little kid, and would see books, not the really sexy ones, because I couldn't find those. it kind of felt like anybody could write a romance novel, and you just send it in, and they'll publish it, because
I think people still
have
really that.
It's a really booming industry at the time.
But I think people still have that misconception.
I think they do. I just listened to a book on tape, a romance that was written in 1984.
Was it that?
Oh, it fit the image.
Yeah.
See,
compared to
it's just come so yeah. far. And I know with Harlequin, when my agent first told me about Desire, she said, now, they accept less than 1% of their submissions. And they get thousands a day. And I thought, what? And you told me you did what?
But you did.
Yeah, I'm just saying, that just proves right there, not anyone can just sit down and write a romance. It's more than the romance. There's a story in there.
There's a story and there's strong characters.
Mm-hmm.
And readers are getting more educated, and they expect to see that in what they're reading.
Yeah, their standards are way higher.
And we don't want heroines anymore who just sit around waiting for Prince Charming to do everything, which is another stereotype of romance.
Or too stupid to live.
Too stupid to live.
Yeah.
Well, then kill them.
And some are very, very funny.
Yeah,
right.
Humor is a good
right.
thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't read your book yet.
What have you been doing here?
I don't know.
Yeah, we know.
You can find a way back.
Right.
See if we can find a way home.